Well, thank you for that, Mr. Seeker. It's a joy to come down here and see everybody. It really is. It's an opportunity for me to spend some time on the road and drive through with what is some truly beautiful country on the way down here, especially this time of year. You know, as we're looking outside, and it may be a little bit gray and it may be a little moist right now, but the pop of the green and the color of the blossoms at this time of year are really beautiful. And I looked at Mr. Seeker's face, and he has a certain boyish energy today. And I figure he probably got a little more time out in the field doing the things he loves to do this week, maybe than he has in the past. And I've been doing the same. Even yesterday, I was down on the creek last night after I got home and working things up. A little labor of love that I've been doing down there. The way our home is laid out, there is only one window on the entire front of our house. And I don't know if that was by their design, that they didn't want to see the neighbors or the traffic, but there's only one window. And that window, I don't think anybody here has been to our house yet, that one window is a glass block cross. We didn't buy the house because of that. But in our master bathroom, which points to the porch in the front yard, there's this glass block cross. But of course, you can't see out of it. So my wife is a little bit uncomfortable that when she lets the kids out into the yard, she can't see them. And so she literally has to run to the front, out onto the porch, and see the kids. So we have been clearing about an acre and a half down in the creek where they can be off of the road, visible from the dining room and the kitchen. And so I've been outside digging and pulling and cutting and burning and disking and just having a blast. So my wife says, yeah, you have that boyish grin too. So, and then I saw the extra little smile when that third song didn't quite work out the way he said. And I wonder if that was a fix, you know? Every once in a while this happens, and then bang, there it happens. But, it happens. Well, I bring you greetings from Buffalo. Everybody seems, for the most part, people are doing well. I know we're passing around some colds and some kind of spring flu. And I know this time of year with the early blooms and the heat that we had, the allergies seem to be pushed a little bit more than usual. And so a couple at my house have been handing it back and forth. And so there's a lot of hacking and coughing going on. But other than that, everybody seems to be doing pretty well. Excuse me, I may have a little bit of that myself today. Mr. Holloway, in his message today, referred to a couple of things that led or lead in nicely to my particular message. He mentioned love of your neighbor, and that's going to be the significant, not necessarily neighbor, but love is going to be the particular topic I speak on today. He talked about the spring holy days, and there's certain things that we come out especially strong of the spring holy days with. And as we emerge from the spring holy days, it never ceases to amaze me at the sense of wonder that I feel each year as we come out of them. At this time of year, more than any, I feel small. I feel humbled. You know, we often talk about the Day of Atonement and how physically we feel ourselves humbled because that energy begins to ebb by the end of the day. And we recognize that it doesn't take much to push us off our game. You know, that pursuit of happiness, we don't feel happy. We don't have the energy to pursue much at the end of the Day of Atonement. And so there's a temporary feeling there. But at the spring holy days, when I recognize what has taken place thousands of years ago, but what has taken place, it helps to put me in my place. And I'd like to refer, first of all, to John 15:13, because it says, greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. Now, we've all seen movies, or we've read books, or we've heard of someone who had a friend, often in war, where somebody saved somebody else's life, or somebody fell on a grenade, or something like that. And that act of selflessness eternally links the saved to the memory of that person that gave their life. And very often what it does as well is to say, you know what, that person feels a responsibility to then help watch over or assist with the loved ones of that person that gave their life. As we come through the time leading up to the Passover, I find myself taking a very personal sense of that particular verse, John 15:13, greater love has no one, as I know we all do. And I also know that there's a saying out there today, and people wear the little bands that say, what would Jesus do? WWJD. And sometimes some of us grouse at that. You know, we don't feel comfortable with the regular use of Jesus, the name or the word Jesus. But I think we need to be cautious and set aside that sometimes that judgmental opinion that we have, and maybe change that question a little bit to what did Jesus do? And as we come out of the spring holy days, let's not lose that concept, that connection, as we go about our pursuit of happiness. And as Mr. Holloway mentioned, as we show love to our neighbors, as we recognize a responsibility that we have coming out of the spring holy days and having had our debt paid, that we have a responsibility to be more like Christ and more like God the Father. And we know that in 1 John 4:8, it tells us that God is love. And so that's what I'd like to speak on today, because as we come out of the spring holy days, we have to have more of that, and we have to be more of that too. This morning, brethren, let's look at the topic of godly love, because it's a critical step in us becoming sons and daughters of the Most High. Now, the Greek language has three primary words that we use for love and the concept and different kinds of love. It enables us to distinguish the difference between the passionate affection that we have or devotion that we have, and that's identified by the word eros, E-R-O-S, eros. There's a warm affection, there's a friendship, if you will, called philia, and then there's the Christian love that's identified by the word agape. Vine's Expository Dictionary has the following to say about agape. It points out really three different aspects of agape. It says, first of all, it is used, A, to describe the attitude of God toward his son, those that believe on the Lord Jesus Christ in particular, and third, under this first point, because again, we're talking about the love that God shows in three different ways, and the third one being to the human race in general. The second point it makes is to convey his will, God's will, to his children concerning their attitude toward one another, that within the family here, and toward all men. So on the second point, there's effectively two subpoints. And then C, to express the essential nature of God, because again, it tells us that God is love. And so I'm going to take a few minutes and go through. There's six points played out there, and we're going to go through them in a little more detail. That first point, it says God's love toward his son. And we can turn to John chapter 17 and verse 26. John chapter 17 and verse 26. Here Christ is speaking to the Father, and it says, I have declared to them your name, and I will declare it, that the love with which you loved me may be in them, and I in them. So we see first here the concept of love between two supreme beings, between the Father and the Son. And he says, the love that we have shared, the love between you and me, then I wish through the teachings that I've made, that they would begin to understand that and experience that and apply that. But it speaks first of the love that existed and continues to exist between two beings that are indeed, it says God is love. And so there's a very special, very perfect love that exists that we all strive to understand a little better and then to some degree play out and live and practice in our lives. That was that first point from John 17:26. The second of the six points that it makes here, and again, remember the first three really talk about God and then the love that he shows. The second point, let's turn it back a couple of chapters to John chapter 14. The second point here, John chapter 14, verse 21, and this is God's love toward his church, God's love toward his children. John chapter 14 and verse 21, and it says, he who has my commandments and keeps them, again, Mr. Holloway referred to, you know, love your neighbor, keep the Sabbath day holy. Those that have those commandments and base their life on that rock-solid foundation of God's instructions on how we're to live and relate to him and relate to our human counterparts. He who has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him. And so here we see, again, that perfect love as the epitome of love between the two supreme beings, and God is love. And then the next, he says, you know, those that know me and those that know the Father, they see that love applied in their lives too. And they see the love played out through the instructions and through the law and through the commandment and how it applies. And so the second point is that God, through agape, helps us to understand how he relates to us and how he loves us. Again, a mutual love between the Father and Son, and then how that is applied to us. Point number three is that God's love is shown toward mankind generally. We can turn to Romans chapter 5 and verse 8. Romans chapter 5 and verse 8, where it says here that God demonstrates his own love toward us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So this shows the third point, that before we were part of the family, before we were part of the body, God gave his son to pay the price for all, to pay that mortgage debt for all. And again, God sees through the issues that we have. God ultimately sees through the issues that everybody has, and he sees the potential that he created in mankind. And he knows that in the future, despite the fact that some will not respond today, he knows that that potential is there, and ultimately the debt will be paid, the fog will be lifted, and the commitment and the relationship will then be able to be tagged very specifically to each and every man and woman out there. And so there's a love, again, between God and Jesus Christ. There's a love that's shown to the body today that is striving to live by those commandments. But there is a love that, for the time being, is suspended to some degree, but ultimately will make that opportunity available to all. Point number four, and here's where we now step down to mankind and our relationship and how we are to show love. Point number four, we can turn to John chapter 13 and verse 34. This is a love between the brethren. So we've seen God's love. We read of God's love between him and his son, Jesus Christ. We see it applied liberally to us. We know that it will extend at some point to all of mankind. But in John chapter 13 and verse 34, we have direction as to how we are supposed to now show that love. So again, this is not something, okay, God is love, and then we go about our pursuit of happiness. Mr. Holloway pointed out the fact that when you disengage that pursuit from the instruction, from the parameters, from the rules under which it's supposed to be pursued, it becomes all distorted and disheveled. And so here we are to do all that we do with that love. And first of all, we show it toward the brethren. And that's in John chapter 13 and verse 34. It says, "A new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you." So as we looked at that love that's shown from God down to us, we're to show that same and extend that same love to the best of our ability to others as well. "That you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another." And continuing in verse 35, it says, "By this shall all men know that you are my disciples." They're going to see the example. They're going to see that we set aside our opportunity to mow our grass or the opportunity to go to a football game or something like that because someone else is in need. And we're mowing someone else's grass too. And okay, all right, well, that's a very nice thing. They may not understand all the reasons why, but they do take notice. And there will be a time really when they understand why it is what we do. But they'll know that we are his disciples because we follow in that pursuit of happiness. And what brings us joy sometimes is not pursuing our own, but it's pursuing the happiness of somebody else. And they'll know that we are his disciples. Again, there's a love between the brethren that clearly ties us back to God. The fifth point that Vine's Expository Dictionary pointed out in regard to agape, that godly love, is how we should show love toward other men as well. Other men, other women, our neighbors, our coworkers. We can turn to 1 Thessalonians for this one. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 12. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 12. Paul is writing here to the church and says, "And the Lord make you to increase and abound in love one toward another and toward all men, even as we do toward you." So again, as that example is given with Jesus Christ and God, and then their love toward us, we certainly, because of that natural inclination and understanding and the relationship that we share and the view that we have for the future, we show a higher regard for love and concern for the congregation. But we're certainly to extend that to mankind as well. "And the Lord make you to increase and abound in love one toward another and toward all men, as even as we do toward you." So again, there is a godly love extended to us, and we then are to do more of that ourselves toward everyone. Perhaps that act of love, that act of outgoing concern towards somebody else, will be the seed that's planted to get somebody to ask why and ask more and allow someone else to be drawn. And then point number 6, the final one that's given in that those 3 points and the subpoints, is in regard to the essential nature of God. And I referred to this earlier in 1 John 4:8. It says, "He that loves not clearly doesn't know God, for God is love." And so as we pursue that happiness, as we pursue that example, and as we try to live more closely by it, it brings us full circle back to the perfect love that's the basic trait of a supreme being and something that we look forward to, something that we will be ultimately capable of someday when we've shed the physical restrictions that we have. Brethren, we begin to see the complexity of the topic of love, and it has to be an integral part of every relationship that exists, no matter how large, no matter how small, no matter how extensive and long-lived it is or how brief it may be. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. We refer to it as the love chapter. It's the most exhaustive treatment of this kind of love in the Scripture, 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And we're given here over a dozen descriptors, if you will, situations or explanations of what love is, what it looks like when we practice it, when we put it on, and we show it toward others. First of all, before we get into here, I want to give you some of the context of the book of 1 Corinthians. Again, Mr. Holloway referred to the fact that when a document is written, when a story is given, understanding the context and the meaning and the history and the supporting environment around it helps us to understand more clearly the actual words that are given and the story as it plays out. In the book of 1 Corinthians, we recognize that it's addressing a struggling group of Christians in a very ungodly city. Corinth was one of the major metropolises in Greece, one of the richest and most important cities in the Roman Empire of its time. Halley's Bible Handbook refers to it as a renowned and voluptuous city where the vice of East and West met. Again, you know, you talk about the New York cities, you talk about the Los Angeleses, you talk about the Vegas or wherever it may be, and it's, you know, when you bring that concentration of people that are pursuing their own happiness and their own property, there's a certain difficulty, there's a certain energy that feeds on itself, and that vice comes together. And although you have some very well-meaning people in there, you're going to have those that try to take advantage. You're going to have those that take it to extreme because they don't live by the rules and the commandments that we have, and therefore you're going to find that vice. Certainly not a model city of God when we talk about the city of Corinth here. We also know as we start this story that it's been a few short years since Paul founded the church in Corinth. So in this environment that is difficult in its own chemistry, you have a group of believers that are only a few years old. And when their founder, when their champion, if you will, has moved on to found his churches elsewhere, they continue to be affected by the infection of that around them, and therefore they find themselves beginning to be pulled and moving perhaps back toward what it was they came out of. So in a short time, there had developed some very serious problems within the church in Corinth. They included things like pride and politics, issues of immoral participation in the practices of the day. Again, how close can you be to that environment? And if you came out of that business environment and you still have to interact with them, how is it that you can keep yourself strong when you have to deal with that? It's a very real challenge. There was incest in the church. There were legal wranglings between members and so on. All this was going on within and between the members of the church. And Paul's letter seeks to address the issues in an effort to get this fledgling church back on track, back operating within those commandments in their pursuit of happiness. Adam Clark's commentary on chapter 13 says, at the conclusion of the preceding chapter, the apostle promised to show the Corinthians a more excellent way than that which they were now proceeding. They were so distracted with contentions, divided by parties, and envious of each other's gifts, that unity was nearly destroyed. It was evident that love to God and man was wanting, and that without this, their numerous gifts and their abilities or capabilities and other graces were nothing in the eyes of God. Paul, by his advice and direction, gives discourse to the many abuses. He points out the specific things, and you know, there, as he would have said something, I expect that he wasn't, you know, he doesn't drop names here. But as he was saying things, you know that the people that were reading or hearing this letter, you know, were kind of grousing. They knew, and their neighbors knew, because there was a very contentious group, and they were, again, many times fractured within their own group, and therefore they knew to whom and to what he was speaking. It says, gives discourse to the many abuses and shows them how to walk in such a way as to please God. So this gives us a little bit of insight into the first section of chapter 13. In verses 1 through 3, Paul addresses the preeminence of love. He starts to lay the groundwork, having told them that there is a better way. He starts to lay the groundwork here. And despite the capacity that these people had, despite the background that they had and their skills, if you will, their fruits, their abilities, he was telling them that there was a much better way and that those things were not going to carry the day if they didn't have love. Let's begin in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 1. Again, he lays the groundwork here. 1 Corinthians. Chapter 13 and verse 1. As though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I become as sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And so here he's talking about the fact that regardless of what it is that you may have, regardless of what you have proven yourself capable of, if it doesn't come from the foundation of agape, that true concern for the benefit of others, first and foremost, to your own pursuit of happiness, you become white noise, if you will. You know, somebody out there beating a drum, trying to get their own attention, but just noise. Verse 2, and though I have the gift, or despite the fact that you may have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, so regardless of what your IQ may be on both a physical and a spiritual level, and though I have all faith so that I could move mountains, but if I have not love, I am nothing. So again, what he does is he starts to say, wait a minute, all these things that you have hung your hat on, all these badges and ribbons and medals that you like to wear around, or the patches on your arm that says you've got a certain number of stripes, you're capable of something that maybe somebody isn't, and you're starting to become a little puffed up and proud by that, regardless of what it is, if what's inside is not right, you might as well just dispose of the patch, because it's useless. He says, I would be as nothing. Verse 3, and though I bestow all my goods and feed the poor, you know, we see that too. We've seen some people do some wonderfully loving things, traveling this world, building schools, teaching people multiple languages, helping them to use computers, helping them to start small businesses, you know, our church, Mr. Kubik's doing the same type of thing when he goes to these areas and say, you know what, a simple couple of cattle or a simple handful of chickens will make the difference in the long-term blessing and wealth and ability to survive of some of these families. But despite all these things, if I bestow all that I have to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but if I have not love, it profits me nothing. I can give something, and the person that has it on the other end is going to have some value. They're going to have something that I had previously. But it's not the badge of honor for me. And it doesn't ultimately do anything for us if we do it from an incorrect basis, if we don't do it from that true selfless act, as Jesus Christ said for us. It profits me nothing. Paul begins by providing a sense of priority, letting the church know that their infatuation with these gifts, they're wanting to stand and be noticed, you know, to make sure their right side is turned toward the camera so that people can see what they've done, that perhaps their resume is out there. He says that really doesn't matter, and you're wasting your time. You're preventing yourself from living these things and practicing these things the way God had intended to you. You're missing the big picture. The second section of this chapter, verses 4 through 7, set the specifics of what we should and shouldn't see when love is in proper focus. And this is very often what we think of, these few verses that give us all these descriptors, all these specific points on how love is applied, what it does and doesn't do. So let's go through each one of these, and what I'd like to do as we go through them is to expand on each one of these things, when it says love is or love isn't, and make sure that we understand. So again, as we come out of the spring holy days, and as we now go through this first extended period just past and this next holy day, let's make sure that maybe we go back to 1 Corinthians a couple of times, and we recognize, as Psalm 15, it says, "Who shall dwell on my holy hill?" Here's the list of descriptors of the personality and the character traits of who shall dwell with me. And if we go back to 1 Corinthians 13, we see the qualities of love that really in a great degree mirror that Psalm 15 list, because it's what this person does and what they wouldn't do. Verse number 4, love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. Love is not puffed up. Looking at that first particular piece, it says love is long-suffering, or love suffers long. The Greek word here is makrothumiai, and it hints of taking a long time to get hot. One of the situations that I thought of when I read this particular point, remember the earthquake that we had a couple of years ago in Japan? And one of the greatest, certainly the devastation was incredible. And yet one of the things that captured the headlines for weeks and months and still is not under control was the nuclear reactor that was affected by it. And when you think about a nuclear reactor, you think of something that's just got an incredible amount of power and energy that is then used to somehow focus that energy and make it useful to mankind, because in and of itself it can be absolutely out of control. And there are fail-safes, there are systems engineered into such a plant or a location to make sure that it doesn't overheat, because the devastation can be incredible as it was here. And so what we see here when it says love is long-suffering, it means that it is effectively those control mechanisms. It is those insulators. It is those cooling mechanisms that are built in to make sure that we don't blow, that we don't overheat, that there is control between the relationships, that sometimes there's friction. We have to recognize, again, that there are systems built in to insulate and control. Another analogy that we could use would be that of a teapot. It's been used many times. And, you know, when you put a teapot on, if you're making yourself just one cup of tea and you put it on there, just like that, it comes up to heat, you know, and it's screaming at you in a hurry. And if you wait just a little bit, you're not going to have a cup of tea, because it will just be gone out of that spout. If we, in the same way as Christians, are shallow, if we don't go deep enough, if we don't put enough in that tank, then when that friction happens, we don't have the ability to keep things cool, to keep things under control. And then our end result of that positive thing, that cup of tea that settles our nerves at the end of the day, is lost. So again, we have to recognize that love is long-suffering. If we, by extension, or opposite to that, are mature, if we're deep, we have the ability to keep it under control, and then it becomes an effective process, and it takes us toward our intended end. You know, there are going to be those that try to rub us the wrong way. There are going to be people, there are going to be situations, there are going to be budget changes that need to happen, and they're going to affect our lives. And the question is, we recognize that Jesus Christ was beaten and hung on a cross, and through all of that, he was able to stay cool. He was long-suffering, and he did that on our behalf. No greater love has a man than he laid down his life for his friend, and Christ did that for us. So we have to recognize that the things that we face in this life, do we have that quick temper? Do we blow quickly? Do we get irritated easily? Or do we have the ability? Thick-skinned is sometimes seen as a bad thing. But, you know, when that little burr is under the saddle, do we find ourselves overly sensitive to it? Or do we have the ability to put that layer, that thick skin there where it needs to be at the time where it needs to be practiced and be long-suffering? A great many people in this world would bear far fewer physical and emotional scars if they had that ability to be long-suffering. If they had that ability to insulate at that moment of transgression and not blow. If they had the ability to be slow to speak, slow to lose their cool, and if they had shown the forgiveness that we're supposed to show, more love. The second point says here that love is kind. In Proverbs chapter 19 and verse 22, it says, "That which makes a man to be desired is his kindness." You know, we can look at somebody's stature, and people love to be around the movie stars and the rock stars and the football players. But very often it's because you want the notoriety and you like the publicity and you like the big parties and that type of thing that happens. But when the cameras are gone, and at the end of the day, and when you're having a hard time, you know, is that football player going to come over and put his arm around you and truly be concerned about what it is that you're going through? He's pursuing his own happiness. It's the kindness of that individual that comes over and works on the car and mows the grass when you can't and helps in so many ways, or just spends time, even maybe not next door but over the phone, gives you that shoulder to lean on, that shoulder to cry on. Kindness is an incredible blessing when somebody shows it to us. In preparing for the message, I came across the quote. It says, "There is many a woman who would trade a handsome husband for a kind one." You know, the very first physical relationship that God put on this earth was the husband and wife. And the sanctity of the marriage and the strongest relationship physically that should ever be is in incredible decay today. Because we often look, and again, as Mr. Holloway said, not we, but mankind, with their distorted look of things, looks on the football player and the rock star and the car and where can we go and how often will I get to travel and how many carats is the ring that I'm going to get. There is many a woman who would trade a handsome husband for a kind one. How sad that, again, that very first relationship that God put here is in such decay. One of the places where there's supposed to be that greatest degree of love and outgoing concern is in short circuit. We know that kindness in this society is something that, you know, we almost marvel at when we see. It sometimes makes the front page of the newspaper because it's something that people want and desire and too often don't find. Kindness. Love is not jealous. Jealousy is a feeling of displeasure with the prosperity of another. Again, when people pursue their own happiness, sometimes they get jealous. They get unhappy with the fact that somebody else got more of it than them, or they got it more quickly than them, or I got something, but it wasn't exactly what I wanted. I wanted what they had. And they find themselves unable to be happy, to content with what they have at the time. Song of Solomon, chapter 8 and verse 6, says the consuming flames of jealousy are as cruel as hell. That little fire, that little ember that begins to glow inside very quickly can get fanned into a flame that just consumes people, that burns them out from the inside out. Someone fueled by the love of God will rejoice, however, at the success of others. And so even the smallest things that we can appreciate, we recognize our blessings. You know, that pursuit of happiness, again, is a blessing that we're given. Those fruits and those things that we find ourselves developing and able to shower on others gives us that added strength and enjoyment and happiness simply by doing something for others. Love is not jealous. It says love is not puffed up, and the Greek here denotes one who is inflated with a sense of personal pride. You know, having just come through the days of unleavened bread, we've talked about leaven, and we've talked about sin, and we've talked about that puffed up nature that people have. We've also talked and we've heard a lot about replacing them, even the smallest bits of them, with character qualities like sincerity and truth. And so when we see love, love is the ability to put oneself secondary. Not first, not puffed up, not on the front line, not, again, seeking the most notoriety or the most accolades, but rather putting oneself behind and making sure that others are taken care of. The scriptures tell us in a lot of places that pride has a number of problems. You could write down Jeremiah chapter 49 and verse 16. Jeremiah chapter 49, verse 16, it says that pride deceives the heart. And what does it say? That out of the goodness of one's heart, one speaks? Well, if our heart is deceived, if our heart is really, instead of being able to show love and concern for others, if it's really turned inward into a certain selfishness, then again, it's deceived and it can't operate the way God intended it to. When we looked at those 6 points of agape, we're supposed to be mirroring back the love of God back to Him by the way we live. And we're supposed to be showing it here within the congregation, certainly, but we're supposed to be showing it to our neighbor as well, always. But if our heart is deceived, it's cockeyed and it can't do it in a proper way. In Daniel chapter 5 and verse 20, talking about pride here, when it says love is not puffed up, Daniel chapter 5 and verse 20, it says that pride hardens the mind. You know, when we look at a little one and they bruise their knee or something like that, and our heart and our mind wants to reach out, that's the way it should be. That's love. That's outgoing concern. How can I make it better? How can I stop the pain, the physical and the emotional? But pride, when we're puffed up and we're looking at our own self and we're trying to put ourselves out in the best possible light, it hardens the mind. It creates that shell over our ability to think of others because we're thinking too much inwardly. Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 18 says, pride results in destruction. Proverbs 16, 18. Pride results in destruction. Maybe not today. Maybe you will pursue happiness and you'll find a particular success. But in the long run, if you're operating from that sense of pride, which takes care of self, instead of one of love or outgoing concern for others first, then it will lead to destruction because it creates that twisted sense of reality. Love, on the other hand, is characterized by genuine humility. Brethren, we've only been through the first verse here. We've only been through verse 4 in these descriptors, and we begin to see already just how thorough, just how complete this description of love is in chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians. Let's move on to verse number 5. Verse number 5 gives us another list here, laundry list of things that love is and love is not. Verse 5 says, love does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, and thinks no evil. So four more points here in verse number 5. Let's look at each one of them here. Love is not rude or unseemly is another word for that. The Greek expression here for unseemly suggests a notion of being without form. You know, we said earlier that mankind was created He didn't morph. He wasn't some glob, you know, that crawled out of the soup. But that's when it says unseemly or rude here. It talks about that without form. There's a certain ugliness that human nature can have, that pride can have, that selfishness can have. And it just kind of goes its way with no real positive end or goal in mind. The commentary says here, it could be considered to encompass all sorts of evil activity, bad manners, and brutality. You know, we've seen some of those movies, those scary movies where there's this, you know, just this glob, this black force, this shadow that's out there that's a bad thing. And that's what this rude or unseemly nature would be. Love, as we can see through the verses we'll cover today, has a very specific form. It is something that's beautiful and righteous in its structure and in its form and in its practice toward others. The second one here in verse 5, it says that love seeks not its own. Someone with true outgoing concern for their fellow man will think of their own interests only after they know that the interests of others, the needs of others, have been taken care of first. You know, we want to get out of the rain. We pull that door open and we rush in and just let it slam in front of the person behind. Or do we hunch our shoulders to the rain and we hold the door, or, you know, the snow is blowing in our face and we've got a family of 6 or 7 little kids that are all dragging their diaper bags and stuff in? I'll stand here in the cold, and a little bit of rain on my neck is just fine. It'll dry. But I put the needs of others first. And don't run. Take your time. Don't slip on the ice and snow. My comfort is not what's most important here. It's those little chicks that are all, you know, working their way in, or the elderly that are going to take a little bit slower. Our parents and our grandparents teach us that when we're young, that we put the needs of others first. It's been said that there are two kinds of people: those who are always thinking of their rights, what they deserve, and those who concentrate on their responsibilities. Responsibility has the concept of an outgoing need, the responsibility for the welfare of others. It's truly a shame when we consider that today there are too few that live their lives as a member of that second group. And so when we think about the fact that we've come out of the spring holidays, when we recognize that our debt has been paid, when we recognize that our shortcomings are recognized and forgiven, do we turn around with that same love and practice that, and therefore, as a mirror to God's love, show that to all mankind, of which they will take notice? The third thing that it says here in verse number 5, it says, love is not provoked, and what it really it says here, or thinks no evil, the two of those that are kind of put together in the commentary, it says, love takes not account of evil. The descriptor here deserves some attention. It doesn't mean that we ignore evil. You know, when sin takes place, it needs to have the light of truth shown on it. It needs to be pointed out. Now, we can do that in a loving way. What is it? It says, when your brother goes astray, those that pursue him or her and point out the sin, you know, I'm not going to say it into the microphone, but, you know, I got to point this out. For your benefit and the benefit of the family, I need to point this out. What does it say? It says, you recapture, you preserve, you bring that brother back to the fold. There are those in the world that hope that it puts them in a better light when they can, do you see what they did? You know, they want to be the ones that are always writing the stories. They're airing the dirty laundry. Where we're not supposed to take account of that evil. We don't ignore it, but we don't lambaste people with it, and we don't try to put it on the front page. When evil needs to be exposed or rebuked, love is prepared to stand its ground and call someone on the carpet. But the Greek word for account here really refers to a commercial expression. It suggests someone who's keeping a record, like someone who's accounting for a particular transaction. Some people in this world keep tabs on the favors, assuming that they'll be able to call them in later. And it's happened in the church as well, brethren, but it shouldn't. or it's something that perhaps is way back in our character, but it's something that we need to get over. We need to burn that set of books. God's keeping track, and he has the only really important set of records that's out there. And so some, again, would say, you know, remember when you did such and such, and I didn't say anything? Well, they didn't say anything with the intent to be able to write it in their book and call that marker back in, because now I need you to look the other way. And it doesn't do that. It doesn't keep a count in order to get back its own or get relief from something later that it shouldn't. And it talks about when it says keeping account of an evil, it means keeping tabs so that it can take advantage of it somehow later. Love, on the other hand, doesn't keep score, and we've got to make sure that we're not doing that. It's typical for human nature. We're very social individuals. We want to be noticed. We want to be appreciated. We want to be socially aware of those around us, and we want them to be aware of us as well. And so we need to be careful that we're not keeping tabs. You know, do we allow something to get under our skin and have that little jealousy or that little grudge or that little record of something? You know, why isn't it that the boss, or why is it that the boss didn't recognize me in front of that customer? You know, I would have felt better about myself if the boss had introduced me to that big customer as they walked in, but he just walked by me and he left me out of it. Do we let that fester? Do we let that get under our skin? Or, you know what? A couple of times this week, my wife didn't respond to me when I said something to her. Do we let that begin to fester? Do we keep account? Are we keeping track? Or are we showing love to say, you know what? People are busy. People don't feel well. People are thinking about what the afternoon is. Maybe people are not as socially adept as you'd like them to be. But when we start to keep track of that, we put ourselves in the wrong column in that ledger ourselves. And as I said, God is the one that's keeping track. And we're going to have to give an account for each one of those things. Now, there are going to be those that are on the wrong side of the page that we're going to have to be forgiven of, and we know that payment has been made. But there are things on the good side of that page, too, and we have to be working very hard to make sure that side of the ledger is becoming overly weighted as we recognize the love that God has shown to us, as we're humbled by coming out of the Passover and recognizing what has been paid on our account and the love that's been shown to us. And then practicing that downstream as well. Love doesn't keep score and allow an irritation to develop. Instead, it practices perpetual forgiveness. In Matthew chapter 18 and verse 22, we see the parable of the master that was kind and forgiving, willing to erase an enormous debt. And that represents the debt that has been paid by Christ for us. In turn, that servant was unwilling to show that same love, that same forgiveness, even just a piece of it would have sufficed. And it goes on to say that the master repented of the love that he had shown at that point and said, you know, you didn't deserve what was shown. You had the opportunity to simply spring forward from what you were given and do something positive, and you couldn't even get there. And therefore, it says he was turned over to the tormentors or the torturers. So what we have there is the extremes shown in that love will lead us toward eternal life. Love will lead us toward the kingdom that we're all pursuing. But that pride and that selfishness and that keeping account ultimately gets us turned over to spin our wheels on our own. Again, that individual faced a bitter end in chapter 18 of Matthew. Again, God has that important set of records. Let's let him keep track while we simply try to keep our noses clean by practicing what we are taught and what we read in the pages of our Bible. Verse number six here in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, it says, love does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in truth. Now, this one's pretty straightforward, I think. By now we understand that love is concerned with the overall well-being of others. However, we also know that there are those that are diametrically opposed. Much of this world, as we talk about, you know, we're preaching to the choir here when we are going through the scriptures. But when we can give them with our own personal story, when we can help somebody to think about it just a little differently and then go back and recognize, okay, I hadn't thought about it that way before. The truth hasn't changed. But if I, you know, do I automatically think at the Passover of the love chapter? Well, maybe you haven't in the past. And so maybe on your list of things to consider pre and post Passover from now on, you turn back to chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians and say, okay, a special and incredible love has been shown for me. And how can I now spring forward and trampoline into the spring as I have this annual reminder of what it is that's been shown toward me and I should be showing to others? You know, Mr. Holloway talked about watching the news or reading the paper. We talked about Corinth being that east and west coming together and that concentration of people that often just elevate the human nature. We recognize that there are many that create the pain and suffering that we see today. We recognize that we read some of the stories or we hear some of the situations and we're aghast at them. But we don't understand because we're pursuing a very different end, and yet this world is very different from what we intend, what God intends it to be and what we wish it to be. And so as we read those things, we have to recognize that our prayer constantly through the day is, God, thy kingdom come. And until that day, protect your servants, please, from the garbage that goes on out there. How bad is it going to be? Let's turn to Romans chapter 1 and verse 28. We can read several verses here. You know, we often say that things are going to get worse before they get better. And many times we go about our day and blissfully unaware of the difficulties of others, sometimes recognizing our own and helping or asking God's help with our own. But we recognize that this world around us, at times we get an eyeful of just what it is, that the human nature out there and Satan's twisting of this community turn out to be. Romans chapter 1 and verse 28. Romans chapter 1 and verse 28. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind, a twisted mind, a contorted mind, without form and unseemly, to do those things which are not fitting. What is it that's not fitting? Being filled with all unrighteousness, immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness. You know, what is it we were supposed to put off? Was that deceit and that wickedness and that sin from the days of unleavened bread? They're full of envies and murders and strife. Again, that's what the news is full of. You know, we have the Trayvon Martin thing going on in Florida right now. And I don't know. We weren't there. We don't know what's right and what's wrong. We don't know who said what and who pushed the issue. We don't know what the darkness of night created things to look like. Only God has those ledgers truly. And he has that perfect night vision and sees it all. In the long run, that's all going to be forgiven. It's all going to be go away. And he says, you know what? I see the potential in all of mankind. I show love to my son. I show love to you today. And ultimately, that love is going to be applied for everyone. And you need to start seeing and living and acting that way as well, both within the confines of the family and to all that you come in contact with, so that they begin to see the love that I have. They see just a snippet of it through you. Verse 30 goes on, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud. We talked about pride and the fact that love is not puffed up. Boasters, again, pride and braggarts, inventors of all evil things. You know, we can look through the Proverbs and say, you know, those that rush to blood, those that rush to take advantage of others and create that evil, inventors of all evil things, disobedient to parents. Verse 31, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful. Who, verse 32 here, meaning those that would practice these things, again, outside of the realm of our family and our mindset, who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do them, but also approve of those who practice them. So even if they become aware of, they're so twisted, they're so off base, it's so common, it's so a part of the fabric of their lives that they still practice them and are then drawn to those that work, that live that way as life, that way of life. Again, Satan has twisted this world like a pretzel and he's not done yet. We know that. Verse number 7. We've seen primarily here through verse 5 and 6 what love does not do, what love is not. At the end of verse 6, it turns the corner a little bit. It says, love does not rejoice in iniquity, but love is. Love rejoices in truth. Here in verse 7, it says, love bears all things. So now we get a little bit different tack here on what love looks like. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. And again, let's take a look at each one of those. Love bears all things, and there's really two senses to this verb of bearing something, of carrying something. It provides a picture, if you will, when you look at the commentary, it says love bears all things, and it really has, it's like two pieces, like the top and the bottom of a turtle shell, if you will. And it means that there's a lower object that can act in a supporting way. It shows the love by supporting. You know, it's that shoulder that props something up when it needs to be. But it's also the top of the thing, which can act as that umbrella or that protective shell that then can effectively ward off as a shield to that soft underbelly. There's two pieces to that when it says bears all things. Again, love supports and lifts up those who are in need. I mentioned earlier that you can be there to support somebody as a shoulder to lean on or a shoulder to cry on or a voice at the other end of the phone. And that's the first, that's the underside, the supportive side of it. And in the other sense, love provides cover and would be slow to expose the mistakes of others. Again, you know what? There's helping someone to recognize what it is that's happened and needs to stop can be done in a loving and private way. If it leads to the right end, then it's the productive side of love. Quietly mending those things as opposed to airing the dirty laundry in public. Love believes all things is the second thing here, and this doesn't mean that love is gullible, but it has a sense of trusting and giving them benefit of the doubt. We've all made mistakes, brethren, and there are mistakes that we're grateful when someone is providing that cover. When somebody says, you know what, God's already forgiven that. God's already paid that debt, and in my mind, it's paid. And so it's something that you need to understand. It's something that you're going to bear some burden for, the memory of at least, and that's enough. The next one here, it says, love endures all things. Even when adversity challenges again and again, love continues to operate and to keep its cool. Going back to that first concept that we talked about. Love is tough. Love is capable. Love has the ability to be that shell or that shield on top. It's not easily discouraged. True love doesn't give up, but it perseveres. It manages through all the challenges that are faced. It stays the course through thick and thin. Love endures all things. Verse 8 of 1 Corinthians chapter 13 begins the third section of the chapter, and it shows the superiority and eternal nature of love. What I really wanted to focus on were those three verses in the middle that says, as we recognize that love was shown for us, as we recognize that love was, or that debt was paid for us, what are those pieces that we can then take and put into practice each and every day to pay that forward? To help those around us. People and things will pass away, we see here at the end of the verse. Even the supernatural gifts and the qualities that we develop, those fruits that we develop, can be given to and practiced toward others while we live. But our ability to show that love to others will come a point where it's done, where our time is suspended. But love is eternal. God and his way of life, his way of love, are so intrinsically and eternally tied that they cannot be separated. To put it another way, God has been here from the beginning and he will reign toward the end. And love has been in lockstep with him. And it's in fact a part of him, therefore, as we know, as we read earlier in 1 John. on each and every step of the way, and it needs to be with each step that we take as well. Here in 1 Corinthians 13, we're given a very detailed description of what love is and what it isn't, what it does and what it doesn't. And from such a thorough explanation, we can see how this incredibly important character trait is one of the fruits of God's Holy Spirit and how it needs to be practiced more by each of us each and every day. So again, as we come out of the Passover and consider that verse again, that no greater love has a man than to lay down his life, we don't lay down our life. We don't end our life, generally, but we give a little piece of it each day when we show love to someone else. When we put our needs and desires aside for the time being, we give a piece of our life, a piece of our time, a piece of our attention and our heart to someone else. And we give of our life to someone else. Despite the thoroughness of this definition here, if you will, this description, there's something else that I'd like to show as well, because sometimes if we simply read through that, we might think of it too narrowly. Okay, I'm supposed to show love, but how is it that I show it? I saw a little bit of it, what it does and what it doesn't, but there's a larger way that we're told here it needs to be shown. Turn with me to Luke chapter 6 to see another facet of love, an instruction, if you will, about just how to show it and where to show it, because you see, it's not just about being nice to those that are nice to us. It's common and it's easy when we relate to somebody because they did us a favor that I'll pay you back. You had my back? Yeah, I'll pay you back. But we recognize in Luke chapter 6 and verse 27 that to do it right, it has to be greater than that. Luke chapter 6 and verse 27, but I say to you that hear, again, those that are willing and able to hear, because this would have gone right over the heads of much of this world, because it's something they don't want to hear, it's something they don't want to practice. It says, but I say to you that hear, you that are interested and willing to change your lives and follow me, I say to you, love your enemies and do good to those that hate you. You know, I often see somebody kind of stepping back in their human nature and, you know, getting a little bit puffed up and says, wait a minute, I don't really like the sound of this. What do you mean I have to? I don't like that guy. We don't get along, but you're saying I need to be nice to that one? Verse 28 continues. It says, bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. To him who strikes you on the cheek, verse 29, offer the other also. And from him who takes away your coat, be willing to give him your shirt as well. Again, human nature is kind of scratching its head here. It says, did I hear that right? Wait a minute. That doesn't make sense to me when my heart is deceived by pride, when my mind is hardened by pride, when my mind looks inward and say, wait a minute, my comfort level, love means to me that you're going to be nice to me, and if you're not nice to me, why should I be nice to you? Continuing in verse 30, it says, give to everyone who begs from you, and to him who takes away your goods, do not ask of them again. Through the instruction that we get here, first of all, we saw in 1 Corinthians, well, love acts this way. But, you know, human nature, when it becomes uncomfortable, human nature is very quick to step away from things. I don't like that. I don't understand that. I don't really relate to that well. But God is saying, you don't have wiggle room here. I expect you to step up to love, embrace love, and then show love even when it's not easy. You know, if the passage had stopped after the first statement, just, okay, love your enemies, we might have been able to say that, we didn't quite understand, or, okay, I show it in little ways. I won't repeat the gossip that I heard about that guy I don't like, and therefore I'm showing love, okay? Okay, I'm done. God says that doesn't work. There is no wiggle room, because I'm telling you that you got to show it when he slaps you across the face, you give him the other, hard is that? How hard is it not to step back with those fists clenched in front of you, whether it's emotionally, whether it's psychologically that you've been slapped, but just say, okay, Christ says 7 times 7, and give them the other side. When we see somebody do that, you know, that in the old Westerns, you know, where somebody knocked somebody down, you know, and they'd stand up and they'd say, I'm going to give them the shadow of the doubt. And they, you know, they give them the chance again. And you're like, really? That's what God says to do. God goes into great detail here in Luke's chapter 6 about how far this quality of agape love needs to be practiced, how far it should take us. Continuing in verse 31, it says, and as you wish that men would do to you, do so to them. So, okay, well, wait a minute. Now, that makes sense to me, because if that guy did nice to me, I ought to return the favor. That makes sense to me. And if he was a pain in my neck, well, you know, hey, an eye for an eye, doesn't it say that in Scripture elsewhere? There's no wiggle room given here. So really, do I have to do all these other things to which God says, yes, that's exactly and specifically what I require of my sons and daughters. Remember we said earlier that the ability to show that love is a critical quality in us becoming sons and daughters of God. Continuing in verse 32. He says, if you love those who love you, what credit is to you? That's the easy part. We just talked about that. You know, we do nice to those that we like and those that are nice to us. It's natural. Because in a selfish way, if you think about it, okay, they did nice to me, I'll do nice to them. Because I know that they're going to turn around and they're going to do nice to me again. And I like the way this game plays out. That's easy. If you love those who love you, what credit is to you? For even sinners do that. They do it because there's a payback. Verse 33, and if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do that. Verse 34, and if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, what credit is that? For even sinners do that. That's just basic commerce. That's just basic business. So God is saying, I tell you in 1 Corinthians 13 what love is, how to show it, what it looks like, what it does, and what it doesn't do. And then I tell you that you need to do it even when it's tough, even when there's no payback. Verse 35, and here's where the rubber meets the road. Here's where he says, yes, exactly and specifically because that's what I require of my kids. Those that want to be part of my family are going to have the character, the quality of character that I have. They're going to strive to develop it and to overcome the things that I've already forgiven them for, but they still need to overcome them because they still have that propensity. They still have that carnal nature in them that says it'd be real easy to go back to that. Verse 35, but love your enemies. We've heard this. And do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. For your reward will be great, and you will be sons and daughters of the Most High. For he is kind to the ungrateful and the selfish. What did it say earlier? I won't turn back to it. But it says, you know what? He causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust, the sun to shine on the just and the unjust. And he gave his son for all of us before we were members of the family. You know, he didn't say that you've got to cross this line, you've got to strive for this plateau, and then I will give it. He did it first, and he gave us the momentum, the energy with which to get to that plateau. God gave his only son while we were yet sinners, and we read that earlier in Romans 5 and verse 8. He did this on behalf of the ungrateful and the selfish, which we were part of at some point in the past. And sometimes we can find ourselves, you know, if we look back at the end of the day, we recognize that today we were a little closer to that group of ungrateful and selfish because I didn't practice love the way it should have. I didn't practice patience the way it should have. I let that irritation get under my skin a little bit today. I wasn't able to leave it all at the office, and I didn't respond well to my kids when I came home. There's any number of ways we can show it. We have to recognize that we have to do better. As we begin to exhibit God's loving character, even on the small scale that we do in our physical lives, our reward will be eternal life as sons of the Most High. Agape is gracious, determined, and an active interest in the true welfare of others. It said we do it even when it's not easy. It's not deterred by hatred or cursing or abuse by somebody else. Somebody gets promoted over us. Somebody in their incapacity gets transferred into the position that we really deserve. We still have to love those neighbors. And Mr. Holloway said that. It may be a challenge. It will be a challenge because that's how we learn. Sometimes when we burn a little bit, we learn just how much it is that we need to overcome. Agape is not limited by a sense of expectation, but it's based solely on the nature of God. And that brings us back full circle to the fact that that love between Father and Son has been applied to those today that understand, but it's ultimately given because of the potential that each and every one has. And so then with those three layers on top, we recognize that we have to practice it here as we live today. Are we succeeding in showing true, pure, active concern for the well-being of everyone we meet? I quoted from Vine's Expository Dictionary earlier, and it continues on the topic of love by saying the following. Christian love, whether exercised toward the brethren or toward men generally, is not an impulse of feelings. You know, we talk about love. That's that eros. That, oh, I love that person. Remember how your stomach used to kind of turn in knots. I remember my wife and I, when we were dating, when we would drive, she would hold my hand, and she would just kind of scoop it up, and she would hold it with both of hers. And my stomach would just kind of do that little flip. Still funny how those certain things, you know, that's eros. That's that physical love. It's not an impulse of feelings, however. It does not always run with the natural inclinations, nor does it spend itself only upon those for whom some affinity is discovered. Not just for those we relate to. Not just for those that have done something nice to us in the past. And so we enjoy that process and we want to keep it going. Love seeks the welfare of all and works no ill toward any. Love seeks opportunity to do good to all men, and especially toward them that are of the household of faith. Brethren, 1 Corinthians tells us what love looks like. And it tells us at the end of the chapter that love endures and that love is eternal. The time is growing short for this world. You know, we pray, thy kingdom come and thy will be done. And next week would be just fine with us. But the time is growing shorter each and every day. And that means that the allotted time for us to do good to the house of faith and to those that we set an example for, that we touch in some way, is growing short as well. We need to have a certain sense of urgency to be about our Father's business, to be developing that character more strongly each and every day. As a closing scripture today, let's turn to the book of Colossians, chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3, we'll pick it up in verse 12 through 14. We have a powerful responsibility, brother. Remember earlier we said that there were those two groups, those that constantly think of their rights, what they believe they deserve, and those that feel a sense of responsibility. We have a powerful responsibility to spread some love in this world today, and we may not be successful every day, or we may not be as successful every day, but it is my task and yours to strive, to understand, and then to live it the best that we possibly can. Colossians chapter 3, sometimes I don't speak and turn simultaneously. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 12. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 12. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness. You heard earlier that love is kind. Put on humility. I said coming out of the Passover, you know, we should find ourselves perhaps the most humble that we can be all year, recognizing what was just done for us. Put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering. What does it say? You know, love was long-suffering, had the ability to keep its cool. Verse 13, bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. Verse 14, but above all these things, put on love, We have to put on love, brethren, and we have to show it generously. Despite what's coming at us, we have to show it generously. Put on love, which is the bond of perfection.